our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events. From somewhere in the desert, between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Veritas, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
It was too fast to be an airplane.
I think it's time to open the books on the question of government investigations of UFOs. We ought to do it really because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law.
Be skeptical. Do be as skeptical as you want, but by all, don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of the Veritas Show, where the truth will set you free. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for tuning in. If you are new to the show, and were referred by someone, we're glad you joined us and hope you can make yourself at home. I'm working very hard to earn your loyalty. Our special guest tonight is Alan Sturm, ULOs. Unidentified lunar objects revealed in NASA photography. This will be an interesting and interactive interview. Once the interview starts, go to the guests section of our website and click on Alan Sturm so you can follow along. First, I want to share with you a strategy to make the Veritas Show bigger and better. We can do this by spreading the word, and evidently, you're doing a great job. However, I also know spreading the word alone is not enough. Nonetheless, let me report to you that the number of countries that have downloaded our shows was 69 as of last week. As of yesterday, that number has increased to 82. I will report this change every week. At any rate, going back to the new strategy, I want you to help me go viral. And I don't mean creating a virus. As you know, I create this show with my own resources, and now need your help. I'm calling all the truth seekers out there with technical knowledge, graphic, or media design expertise who can help me create a Veritas Show video for YouTube. Anyone who can make a YouTube video is able to participate in this contest. It can be as simple or as fancy as your skills permit. My condition is that you have to use the music I will provide to you. You can find instructions on our website, veritasshow.com. Just go to the show info link and click on the video contest section. I'm proud to announce our association with garageband.com, and most of the music you now hear on this show comes from independent artists. They have also allowed me to use a song which you will now know as the Veritas song, our anthem. It's a song you are listening to in the background. I will play the full version of the song at the end of the show, and I will also make it available to those of you who want to participate in making the video. Imagine how the word can spread if we can tap into the synergy this audience can bring. We will be posting the videos as they are received. Based on your votes, the top three videos will be featured on our website. You can start working on them right now. The contest ends on March 31st, but you can start submitting your videos and I will be reviewing them and posting them on the website. I want you to be part of this show's history as we evolve. And now, some UFO news. I was going to discuss a few UFO news, however, I can only focus on one which I deem it to be one of the most important announcements I have heard in a very long time. Life on Mars. Yes, you heard that right, life on Mars. It's very interesting that although the news originated at NASA, it was not the United States that broke the story. It was the Sun newspaper in London. The article can be found on our blog, but instead of me reading the article, I will let the authority on this topic tell you about it. The real-life Fox Mulder, directly from London, Nick Pope, has graciously accepted our last-minute phone call to brief us on this important announcement. Nick Pope used to run the British government's UFO project at the Ministry of Defense. Initially skeptical, his investigation of newly reported UFO incidents and access to government files on the subject soon convinced him that the phenomenon raised important national security issues, especially when the witnesses were military pilots or where UFOs were tracked on radar. Nick also looked into other mysteries, such as alien abductions and crop circles. He now continues his research in a private capacity and is recognized as a leading authority on UFOs and the unexplained. He has done extensive media work, has lectured all around the world, and has acted as consultant on several TV documentaries.
Hi, hello.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Yes, fine, thank you.
Nick, I heard of methane on the surface of Mars back in 2005, and heard there are no active volcanoes that we know of. Can you please expand on this huge story?
Sure. What seems to be interesting is that scientists are now saying that there is this combination of both methane and indeed water vapor. And these are really two of what you might call the signatures of life. As you say, there are no active volcanoes on Mars. So the methane hasn't come from that process. And indeed, the fact that it hasn't evaporated out of the atmosphere suggests that there is a constant process of the production of methane, which in turn suggests that there is microbial life under the Martian surface, constantly producing this haze of methane. So if that's a very long-winded way of saying we think there may well be life on Mars.
Nick, microbial life. We're just scratching the surface, aren't we?
We are indeed, because if there's microbial life, maybe if we looked other places and if we dug deeper, we would find something more substantial. Life, it's as the saying goes, life will find a way. You look at the situation here on Earth with the so-called extremophiles. It's abundantly clear that almost anywhere that life can get a foothold, it does. Now, this, of course, raises the intriguing possibility that if there was somewhat more evolved life on Mars in the past, when it had liquid water on the surface, as most scientists believe was the case, maybe that life adapted to the loss of that water. So yes, to microbial life, and maybe to something a little bit more substantial.
Nick, does this confirm that we are indeed not alone?
It would appear to be. I think we obviously have to see what NASA say and how this plays out over the next few days with scientists debating it backwards and forwards. There will doubtless be some dissenting voices, as is always the case with this sort of thing. But I think on the balance of probability, yes, I think it proves that we're not alone. And that in turn raises a really interesting point in the wider debate about life elsewhere in the universe. Because if within our own solar system there are at least now two planets on which life has arisen. It does suggest that certainly any sun-like star with Earth-like planets, with these small rocky terrestrial planets like Earth and Mars, it suggests that life may be something that is spread throughout the universe. If the idea is that life can develop quickly and easily, the implication is that the universe will be teeming with life, and that in turn, of course, plays into the debate about whether some of that life might not have evolved rather parallel to ourselves in intelligence, of course, and in evolutionary terms. It's interesting to consider it in strictly scientific evolutionary terms. Intelligence is a pretty good survival strategy.
This certainly is an interesting find and makes me quite curious as to what NASA will report on the idea of life on Mars this afternoon. If it's true, then while human civilization is making a few small baby steps to find out what else lies within the galaxy as well as the universe, things sure are turning toward an interesting aspect in this new year. Isn't it interesting that Great Britain is actually being more proactive? First the Milton Torres story, and now this before the United States? What can you say about that?
Well, I think clearly, yes, we have got a very proactive media here in the UK who are genuinely interested in UFOs, genuinely interested in the wider philosophical questions of life out there in the universe. And the British media do have, I think, a very good track record of bringing these stories out. Now, it's very interesting. One aspect of the whole NASA story that hasn't really come out yet, but certainly will again over the next few days, is of course the political angle to all of this. I believe that NASA's current administrator is due to step down at the end of the Bush term, and this will be a really interesting test for President-elect Obama. When he's inaugurated on January 20th, one of the first decisions he may have to make, and scientists will be pushing for this, is what about a manned mission to Mars? If the scientific data is still unclear, there will be extraordinary pressure to go to Mars. But yet, of course, on the other hand, he has huge financial commitments in terms of the recovery package, his healthcare commitments, things like that. A lot of people see NASA as a something of a white elephant, an extravagance that perhaps we can't afford in the current financial climate. So it's interesting that this news comes out now, just when possibly NASA's budget might have been under some threat from the incoming president. We'll have to see how Obama handles this, and that'll be very interesting.
It is more, without a doubt, it's still more of the stale, pale, slow as a snail, drip, drip release of what they know. But why do you believe the proverbial drip is falling faster lately?
Well, there's a wonderful saying, I think, that it's the whole UFO subject is events-led, and we have had a lot of events over the last year or so. We've had the statement by the Vatican's chief astronomer last May, when he said that there would be no problem with the existence of extraterrestrial life. Then we had Dr. Edgar Mitchell make some extraordinarily positive and bullish statements about Roswell and UFO cover-ups. British Ministry of Defense, of course, releasing its UFO files and creating an international news story. The events over the last few days here in Britain with a UFO colliding with a wind turbine. And this was literally front page news in The Sun, which is Britain's best-selling national daily newspaper here. So a lot of things happening, and I probably only mentioned half of them there. We've had near misses between UFOs and police helicopters, two very spectacular cases over the last few months. We had several UFOs filmed going over a military base. Again, that was front page news in The Sun. It's events. Events are driving this, and I don't know where it's leading, but it's a very interesting path.
Aside from microbial life, what this really tells us is that NASA definitely knows a lot more than what they tell us.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't. I've heard rumors, of course, about this announcement over the last few months. But I've left government service now. I worked for the Ministry of Defence here in the UK for 21 years, but I don't have an inside track on any of this. I don't know what NASA know, but I hope, and particularly with the new administration coming in, I hope that if there is something they know that they're not telling us, now might be a very good time to tell us.
And lastly, Nick, because I know you're doing back-to-back interviews all day long, and you were gracious enough to be with us. Stephen Bassett just said this. American media outlets are not yet reporting the story. Actually, they are as of right now, because they're honoring an embargo, a promise not to run a story until a designated time. The Sun broke the embargo, prompting other media outlets to follow suit. What are your thoughts as to why The Sun and not The New York Times, for example?
Well, I don't know that The Sun did break an embargo. I mean, I'm not privy to how they got hold of this story. It's quite possible. I mean, they're one of the largest newspapers on the face of the planet. It's quite possible that they've got sources within NASA, but I really don't want to speculate on or how they got the story or why they chose to run it. But as far as I'm concerned, they got a scoop and they ran with it.
Nick, thank you so much for being with us. We have to have a full show with you, and we'll get in touch with you so we can schedule it. How's that sound?
Yeah, sure thing. Happy to do that when the diaries allow, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much, Nick. Have a great evening.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
And Nick Pope's website, nickpope.net. Let's take a break, and when we come back, our special guest, Alan Sturb, ULOs, Unidentified Lunar Objects. You may want to start heading to our guest section on our website and clicking on Alan Sturb so you can follow along his presentation. If you want to know what else may be on the moon, you don't want to miss this interview. I'm Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to The Veritas Show. Don't go anywhere. Tucson author Alan Sturm began his ULO, Unidentified Lunar Objects Revealed, in NASA Photography Project as a coffee table book of rarely seen photos taken by astronauts during the Apollo missions using newly released high-resolution images from official NASA archive sources. He says, quote, "Astronauts saluting the flag were out. Stained, damaged, and poorly exposed images of amazing landscapes were in," unquote. With 16 years' experience in graphic design and photography, he wanted to bring these rarely seen images back to life. Tonight's special guest, Alan Sturm. Hello, Alan, and welcome to The Veritas Show. How are you?
I'm doing well, Mel. Thank you.
So you are a computer graphic designer, and you also teach the subject. Obviously, judging by your work with ULOs, you have a keen eye, more so than the average person. I always like to develop the character, in this case, you, so that the audience knows the who. How did you get into lunar anomaly research, and what kind of experience did you apply to get this project done?
It's something you kind of fall into, and then after you've fallen into it, your feet are kind of stuck in it, because then you really start to wonder. It's kind of a niche industry. There aren't too many people doing it. The biggies like Richard Hoagland and John Lear, they've been doing it for years. Personally, when I was putting together the various concepts of the cool coffee table book, that's when I started to notice my own interesting object, the objects that I found that were interesting. And when I realized that I had gotten enough of these, I decided to change the book into that. Now, as far as experience is concerned, or because if anybody out there wants to become a lunar anomaly hunter, I would highly suggest going and taking a class on digital photography and digital editing, like Photoshop class. And with those skills, depending on how well you're taught, you'll know how to kind of take the detail and pull a lot of this detail out of the imagery, at least to get started.
This is going to be an interactive show. So if anyone out there is listening while you're driving, I will make an effort so that you can also enjoy the show. However, if you're listening on your computer or have access to one while you listen, click on the guest section of the website and find Alan Sturm. There you will find a link to his website and the images we'll be discussing as we go along. By the way, you're also a professional, let me rephrase that, a photographer. It's a hobby until you get paid, right?
Right. That's absolutely true. Yeah, I've been doing photography since I was a kid, on and off, and then I also did some photography while I was in the military, for the military, along the east-west German border back during the Cold War.
Interesting. Take us back to your aha moment, the eureka moment, when you said to yourself, wait a minute, am I really seeing what I'm seeing?
Yeah. So as I was compiling these images, and I was just starting to kind of keep a folder of them and kind of developing some techniques on how to really look at them a little bit better or a little cleaner or fixing the contrast levels or whatever. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was sitting there looking at that same picture that I'd been looking at over and over again, I don't know how many times. And like I finally saw the trees from the forest, there was my needle in the haystack. It was the one that I call the needle in the book. And these, what other people describe as wagon wheels, I just sat back and I thought, you know, after I'd been looking at the moon for a long time now, getting used to the terrain, this didn't look like it belonged for real. Like, in other words, I'd seen just basic geometric shapes elsewhere, like in the case of pentagon-like shapes or maybe straight bars across a crater or something like this. Very simple. This was highly geometric and highly detailed. And so I proceeded to work on that all night long, of which that leads into the story of my wife, who was thinking at that time that I might have been going loony, came in that morning and saw what I had been working on, and she agreed as well that I'd probably found something for real. That's when the book took a whole new turn, and that's when I really kind of became a lunar anomaly hunter at that point.
Has anybody approached you saying, wait a second, you're a graphic designer, you have experience in this, are you enhancing your photos? Have you ever gotten that question?
Oh, absolutely. And I tell them, absolutely, I have to enhance them. The way they come from the archive is bland, plain, and poorly exposed. They weren't taking pictures to win any, you know, awards or to hang them next to Ansel Adam prints. They were shooting a lot of pictures for the purposes of just cataloging what they've seen and looking for some interesting geological features and where they could land future missions. So that takes on a whole different tone than looking for the details that I was pulling from the pictures. And those details, there's no way you couldn't use enhancing software to pull that up. But understand, though, that like in my case anyway, I don't know about others, but at least in my case, I always provide, you know, not only a reference to the original, but you see most of the original in there, and then I color them so that you can see what I see. So they're side by side so you can compare. So that people that are thinking, well, you know, you're a graphic designer, you could just paint this stuff in, you could just do whatever. You know, it's right there plain as day, and you can download them from the archive. And once you see them, that's it. You see them. They're there
and,
forever.
And we can't argue with the geometry. That's something we're going to get into later. The geometry, yeah, of seeing perfect shapes, lines, squares, triangles, that's something that you don't see in a natural set.
Yeah. This place should look like, when we get into the pictures here, I have pictures of it. It should look like a World War II bombing run, and that's it. It shouldn't look like a bunch of factories that got bombed out in some places.
You mentioned a few seconds ago, Richard C. Hoagland, Mike Barra, John Lear, all who lately have been involved in similar work, the latter with the moon and Mike and Richard with Mars. Has this work exposed you to new work? In other words, has it hurt or helped your career?
Well, their research is, I would say, different. Now, I have not read Richard and Mike's new book.
Dark Mission.
Yeah, Dark Mission. And I have not read it. I have thumbed through it. It's a big, thick read. I'm a visual person. I was more interested in the pictures in the middle of the book. And I don't know if Richard has any, if he applies his physics or anything else to his new findings, but I don't think that I use them as a springboard, although I can tell you that over time, listening to Richard or John or even some others on other radio shows, that was inspirational. It was inspirational in that I often wondered myself, you know, if we're alone or not. Now, as far as using their information as a guidepost or as assistance in how I prepare my images, no, I don't think there's. I kind of developed my own technique, and it's kind of my signature style, and so no pros, no cons.
What about folks who have been using shuttle photos and finding archaeological and paleontological finds? They have found buried cities in the jungle, cities off coastlines, etc. Have you ever consulted with them to review your moonshots?
No, but that is somebody that I would be willing to put this information out in front of, because they are skilled in they could be hanging out with a tribe of locals, one of the locals might say, oh yeah, my grandfather told me that there was a tribe that lived right down the river here, you know, and they have to go down there and they kind of eyeball that whole scene, looking for irregularities in the terrain to try to figure out where that might have been many years later, and they do. They find stuff like that. Wasn't a lot of the pyramids down in South America, and outlying and other buildings in the area were found that were just covered up in dirt and everything, and they figured out where the stuff is. I would love to actually, you know, show my stuff to some of them. They may be able to discern more detail than I can.
Take the example of Machu Picchu. The date when it was discovered, I forget the date, but I know it was probably found due to a satellite. It's unbelievable that a city like that for thousands of years was unknown to the modern man.
Right. Yeah, and the techniques that they use, I've read in Archaeology Magazine and stuff, they look at all kinds of factors, like the difference in the growth of the trees, where the water should have been flowing, and then it may have been diverted. They have all these techniques, and those, you know, the moon doesn't have Mother Nature, so it gets difficult. So what you can only do on the moon when you're looking at these moon pictures is really just stare into them forever until you get absolutely used to the terrain, and then you start to see these details.
How long did it take for you to actually start, when you started discerning from the usual lunar landscapes that everybody sees everywhere, to finally starting to focus on the little things, the little structures?
I think that when I was finally putting together the book after a couple of test runs, I think I had well over 1,000 hours probably staring at the monitor, looking at moon pictures only. And I know that just because I focused on it so hard, that it was a large part of my life for a long period of time, maybe half a year, and that was the big time period that I was compiling most of the stuff that you see in the book. So about 1,000 hours, and I would suspect that anybody else that wanted to sit down and start doing it like I do, you would probably have to have at least a couple hundred hours in there before you'd really start to find some stuff.
Are all these photos analog or are some digital?
Let's see. Well, in the case of everything that I used in my book, those were all digital scans of the transparencies from the Hasselblad mission, but those are duplicates of the ones in the vault. So they are digital. Some of them were not digitized recently. Most were. Some of them have compression artifacts in them, and some of them don't. It's all digital. It's all digital at this point. I couldn't get it into the book any other way in this day and age.
But all these photos actually came from the late 60s, early 70s. Am I correct?
Yeah. So maybe this is what you're driving at. Is that
correct?
Like the lunar orbiter pictures are they were analog signals, but in effect they were digital as well. But these photos, the Hasselblads, were taken with film, and they were brought back here and developed.
That's what I meant. I meant the first generation of the actual pictures, not the second generation when you take it on a digital format and can actually copy it and reproduce it.
Right. Yeah, interestingly, the lunar orbiter pictures were transmitted back, and from what I read somewhere in some PDF on about the lunar orbiter stuff off the NASA websites is that it was broadcast back almost to like a soundboard, and they could adjust these various frequencies which adjusted the amount of contrast, highlight and shadow that were being saved on their system so that they could turn those into photographs.
During the two-month orbit of the moon in 1994, Clementine captured 1.8 million images of the moon's surface. Mm-hmm. Do you have access to any of those, or have you done any research on those pictures?
Yes. When I was first getting going, I would use the Clementine pictures to try to figure out where I was on the moon when I was looking at a Hasselblad, and so that I could compare and look at a feature from above and look at a feature from down from an oblique angle from orbit. And the Clementine photos, there's a lot of people that love them, and I just can't stand them. They're way too digital for me, and I think they've still yet to release the 2 kilometer resolutions or the 1 kilometer. I can't remember what the maximum resolution was, but all the times I've tried to get hold of those, they're not available. And so we're usually stuck with the ones like you see on YouTube or things like that, where there's big smudges and stuff.
How about access to old Soviet shots or the new Japanese and Chinese photos?
Yeah. The old Soviet Zond pictures are remarkable. You know, I was rather shocked. I didn't know this really about history. I was never a big space buff. But the Russians landed up there and were taking pictures way before we ever did. It was like in 62 or 66 or something. And they were transmitting pictures back. And yet, I've yet to see an on-surface picture that looks anything like the pictures that the Russians landed on the moon. And, you know, so we're talking about the same side of the moon, the same face, because there's no way to transmit that information back to us. In fact, I have a reference to that here. So the JAXA photos, I've only seen some of that stuff, and interestingly, nobody has released any close-ups of the moon either. So I don't know what's going on, but there certainly seems to be a rush of people going back to the moon.
What's your speculation as to why so many countries are heading to the moon, and we won't be going back to the moon until 46 years later from the last time? I'm going to have Dr. Edgar Mitchell in 2 weeks, and I'll certainly ask him that question. But what are your thoughts?
To answer that other question, the Soviet Luna 9 probe transmitted the first pictures from the surface of the moon in 1966.
Okay, that's 66.
So 1966, yeah. And what was the question again about for Dr. Edgar Mitchell?
Why haven't we gone back to the moon in 46 years? It's going to be 46 years the next time we go to the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hard to say. Politics, interest, money, at the industrial military complex. I don't know. And it, you know, because there's things up there like helium-3, like you and I were talking about the other day. There's helium-3 there. We could do an awful lot with that, but we'd have to get up there. I don't know. There are reasons, good reasons why we should have been there all this time, and there aren't any really good reasons why we haven't gone there. Do you know of any?
Absolutely not. And I've asked every single guest the same question, even Stephen Bassett, who's an expert on disclosure, and that's the $64,000 question. Nobody seems to answer. And every time they get an answer from NASA, it doesn't seem to be an answer that anybody would find any logic behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's reasons that we could be there, and there, you know, military reasons. There's military reasons we could even be there. There are science reasons, like we could be observing the Earth from there on an atmosphereless place where we could zoom in with telescopes and other equipment. You know, there's lots of things that we could do on the moon, and not to mention being the outpost for going to Mars, which would be the logical step. And yet,
exactly,
yeah, it certainly seems that it's been ignored. While we've been busy sending all kinds of technology to Mars, we've forgotten about the moon sitting right here in our backyard.
Isn't that strange that all our resources are put into Mars now, and we seem to be forgetting about the moon and the possible resources and renewable energy as helium-3 that could be mined there and the proximity to Earth?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when we start looking at these pictures, we might get into the speculation. We might speculate that mining's already been going on there. So maybe that's the reason why we haven't gone back.
You said that I didn't. Has Alan, have you shared much of your work with Mike Barra, Richard C. Hoagland, or John Lear?
I believe that Mike and Richard have both seen my book, and John, I talk with on occasion, and that's always fun. And I also have conversations with Glenn Steckling, and that's pretty much the circle of the people. Well, now there's you. Other moon buffs that like this topic. So that's about it. Kevin Smith.
Yes, I listened to that interview. It was a great interview. By the way, you semi-opened a little kind of worms when you mentioned the military-industrial complex. I don't know if you knew this, but I spoke to Stephen Bassett on the air about this. And even on NASA's charters from 1958, it says that any findings of life or architecture outside of Earth would be under the jurisdiction of the Department of Defense. So we'll never hear anything about life from NASA. And I suppose that the biggest news would be what we heard today. And by the way, we had Nick Pope earlier in the show giving us a headline of the life on Mars, microbial life on Mars. Mm-hmm. That's a big step right there.
Sure, and to address the, in my opinion, the industrial military complex, which I don't think there's necessarily a head of, but it certainly is a living organism on its own. It's probably the largest employer in the world. I could see why they would think that the Department of Defense should be in charge, for this one reason only, is that the world is still playing this game, like we're all sitting on islands. And it's the storybook Lord of the Flies. And so we fear what we don't know when we stab the pig when it runs in there. And so I could see where the Department of Defense would be put in charge. You know, silly to think that anybody that could get here would probably have the ability to snap their finger and make us disappear instantly. And yet we would want the guys that we trust down here to protect us, they would go up there and try to fight and do what? Lose? Why would they be the ones that we would put in, you know? I would think that it would be smart people like SETI or NASA or something.
National security reasons, nothing else.
Yeah.
Who do you respect in the field?
I respect them all. Let's see, Richard, Glenn, John. Those are my three biggies. I wish that George Leonard was still alive. I would really like to talk to him.
I don't mean to interrupt you. You mean Richard C. Hoagland? Glenn? Glenn Steckling, sure.
Yeah. And his father did a lot of research, and Glenn's been he's a good guy to talk to. I wish that George Leonard was alive. And here's somebody that I really wish that that I could talk to. Michael McCaud. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. M-I-C-H-A-U-D. He wrote the book Contact with Alien Civilizations, and it's just this incredible, dissertation on all the different aspects of what it means and why we might cover up, why we wouldn't cover up. And, I mean, he just goes everywhere. So, as far as, Art Bell, obviously, I'm just pushing the regular buttons here. I mean, I'm not in that deep. I really don't know these people that well. I'm lucky and grateful that I get to talk to any of them.
We're very happy to have you on the Veritas Show, and I strongly believe your hard work will pay off and many people in this field will take notice. Before we take a break, I'll ask you a question and take your answer when we return. Have you talked to any astronauts or cosmonauts about your findings? Also, don't forget, our guest next week will be Stanton Friedman, the father of modern-day ufology. We'll be right back. This is Mel Fabregas, and we're here with Alan Sturm, ULOs, Unidentified Lunar Objects. Don't go anywhere. Now we're back to the Veritas Show. We're here with Alan Sturm, ULOs. And I was asking Alan, have you ever spoken to any astronauts or cosmonauts about your work?
No, but that would be fun. Yeah, that would be incredible. Matter of fact, I reference somebody in one of my videos, and one of the astronauts who took one of the photos from the command module, and he died of a heart attack up here in Arizona.
What was his name?
Oh, yeah, Ron Evans.
Ron Evans. And he died of a heart attack at how old?
Something like 56 years old.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it was right up here in Phoenix. So, I've never had the opportunity. I've never been to the Kennedy Space Center, Johnson Space. I've never gotten to do any of that stuff. I've never seen a live launch of the shuttle. I did see the shuttle fly over in Tucson, but what I'm trying to explain is that I don't really have a history or any hero worship, for that matter, of the astronauts or anything, and I certainly would not pester them with my stuff. If they were to call me, I would have a conversation with them, but I'm certainly not going to chase them down and say, what's this? Honestly, if you're a command module pilot flying at thousands of miles per hour over a crusty lunar surface, And you're taking a picture with a Hasselblad camera that has no through the lens capability, so he doesn't even see what he's taking a picture of. It's a point and shoot. I don't think that he ever slowed down long enough to process anything that he saw. Not to mention the fact that a lot of the pictures were taken with 250 and 500 millimeter lenses. So the details that we're looking at digitally today, thanks to LPI, who is the academic arm of NASA, now we can see these details. This wasn't available back in the day. People used to put a loop on a photograph.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. I did not know that the cameras used by the astronauts did not have a lens to actually somewhere where to view to see what they're taking. Can you describe, if you're familiar with that camera equipment, can you actually focus? Can you zoom?
No, these were fixed focus lenses, and there was no zoom. It's whatever lens you had, whatever power lens you had on there. And to compare it to a 35-millimeter camera, a 75 or 72, somewhere in that, I think 75 is probably the average. 75-millimeter is about the equivalent of a 50-millimeter and a 35-millimeter camera. So a 50-millimeter lens on a 50-millimeter lens on a 35-millimeter camera is equivalent to a 75-millimeter lens on a medium format, like a 5-inch Hasselblad.
I don't mean to throw technicalities out there, but the actual capacity, if you will, would be about 25 megapixels.
Right. So yeah. So we're just barely getting to that now with digital cameras. But that's about the equivalent film resolution is roughly 25 megapixels, give or take. Probably less, maybe a little more, under whatever your shooting conditions are. Which brings us to a not-so-technical issue that most people don't really think about, and that's that the moon doesn't have anything that we would consider to be an atmosphere, you and me. In other words, if we take a picture on the moon and the horizon is 500 miles from me, the only difference in the resolution of the objects of the landscape that we see in that photograph would be when those details get smaller than either the capability of the film to be processed or the grain of the film. There's no atmospheric hazing. So these pictures should have been sharp as can be. And from what I hear, the first people back in the early 70s that were looking at the first prints, they said they were as sharp as could be. So I don't know what happened ever after that.
So are you saying that if you are standing on the moon to take a picture of an object that's probably 500 meters away, and then you take a picture on Earth, same distance, on the moon you'll see the object clear but small, but on the Earth it will be small and blurry?
Yeah. Exactly. Matter of fact, in the book, I have an example that I shot right out on a street, and it shows that even with my digital camera, I can pick up an object that is some 7 miles away on a mountaintop. But the quality of that imagery is so poor, and it's due to the fact that there's atmospheric hazing, that there's moisture in the air, and there's dust in the air, and it's causing a backscattering of light and diffraction and everything else. So on the moon, though, until I read somewhere on one of the NASA websites that there is a little bit of what they called it a lunar breeze, which is where the Terminator line is for night and day. There's such a temperature difference there that it does tend to kick up a little bit of a dust, and they've seen pictures of it during lunar eclipses. And so there is a little bit of an atmosphere, but for the most part, a day is 14 days long. So I would think that what we would call the air is absolutely clear.
Are you implying that? Go ahead. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. What I might be implying?
You are stating lunar breeze, and the first thing that comes to mind are the pictures of the astronauts standing next to the U.S. flag, and you can see the flag flapping.
No, not that kind of a breeze. This is this is a very, very fine dust that you can see when photographing the moon from here. So being that far away, it would be compressed so that you could tell the difference against like a backdrop of the sun. But it's right there on the NASA website. It's on the regular NASA website. And I'll try to find a link for that and throw it up and send it over to you. Don't quote me on it. I don't know if it's a lunar breeze, so don't quote me on that. But that's basically what it was. And it happens right there at that slow-moving line between night and day as it's crossing across the surface of the moon.
Well, why don't we start getting to the nitty-gritty? As I said before, Alan has been gracious enough to provide a page for our audience to follow the remaining part of our interview, where we can actually see the pictures and comment as if a director is actually commenting on a movie. So why don't we go ahead, Alan, and start looking at those pictures, and you can start explaining to me what you see, and then I'll tell you what I see.
All right. The first little batch up here are some early finds. This is what kind of triggered me to get involved. The pentagon-like shape and what looks to be like a pole over a dark shape. These are looking straight down or nearly straight down from a photo taken from a lunar orbiter. I don't remember offhand. It could have been lunar orbiter 3 or 4. I don't remember. But so we're looking straight down. It's a mapping camera whose purpose is to map the surface so that they can know where they are at any time when they're going around the moon and where they were going to land.
Alan, at what speed is the lunar orbiter traversing the lunar surface when they're taking these pictures? Do you know?
I did at one point. I don't remember now. It's pretty quick.
Okay. Go ahead.
And it's pretty far away, too. So, but again, we've got no atmosphere in the way. So you can take a picture from pretty far away and sustain an orbit. And I think most of those orbits were not perfect circles. So I don't know if they even can be. I'm not an expert in that area. I'm sure someone else knows that stuff. Anyway, so what captured my attention about these particular two black and whites up here at the top is the pentagon-like shape with a nodule or a bump, half sphere, casting a shadow on one side, positioned nearly at those crossing points of the geometry, so straight up and down, bisecting it in half, and then from the two outer cornered edges of the pentagon-like area. And what further was interesting is that this is sitting on the side of a crater. That dark area to the right is the edge of a crater. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. How could that be?
You can actually see it under the object to the left. On the lower left side of the right picture, you can see a bit of the shadow. It looks like a shadow, but it's actually a crater.
On the top left photo here, that dark, the big black area on the right is the edge of a crater.
So that's on the right.
Yeah, exactly. Very strange.
On the right of the picture, it looks like a hole, but I presume it's the crater. There's a straight line. It looks like a bridge or a structure. What do you see there?
Oh, did we move over to the next picture to the right?
Oh, to the right. Yes, correct.
Okay, so that one over there, I don't know. It looks like. I know. I can describe it geometrically. We've got a line, a thick white line crossing right over a black spot. Now, when you look at the terrain from these mapping camera shots, you quickly figure out that all those dark little holes are craters. Or they might be, as some have speculated lately, that some of those holes may not be craters. They may be vents from early volcanic periods or something like this. In either case, we're looking pretty much straight down. And so I found that one to be very interesting, that that line extended across that. Now, is it a bridge? I would hesitate to call it a bridge only for this reason. A bridge is named a bridge by its form and its function, and I don't know if anybody needs to walk or drive across the hole.
That's right. That's right. It just looks. It just looks like it.
Right. And so, those are convenient handles that we can use to kind of, describe things that we're used to here on this planet. But for all we know, this is slightly on an angle, and maybe that's a radio antenna. I don't know. But it's certainly, what's interesting is that it's bisecting a crater hole.
Exactly. So my thought on that is, if there was a crater, there shouldn't be anything over the crater. And in this case, there's something over the crater.
Yeah, nobody came back from the missions and all the science missions that went up there and said that there are, crystals growing up there like a science experiment. So there's, as far as we know, there's nothing growing in the, to loosely use the word growing. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. Well, so that started what piqued my interest. And then the one below is actually That's an on the surface shot by an astronaut. That's just a crop of the whole picture, and so the astronaut has the camera mounted. He's either holding it or it's mounted on his chest, and that's taken out of, and that's in the rubble. That's rubble out in front of the astronaut, and he's taken a picture of it. And to me, highly circular, almost looks like a World War II bombshell stuck in there.
Right.
Yeah. And what is further interesting to me about this picture, and some of the your listeners may have already noticed this, is that the shape of that object, where that is in the photo, it's kind of blurry. There's like a motion blur, top right to bottom left. But yet, and I forget the name of them, but the little crosshairs here on the film that were used to help measure and on the Hasselblads, that's nearly perfect, and it's perfect in quality. It's not blurred. So I don't know what happened there. And there's a lot of people that chase around and say, you know, somebody put this over the top of that, and that's why these lines aren't here and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm not going there. All I'm saying, I would point that out as odd. This also is a crop of one of the early photos that I was going to use in the original book, because it was heavily stain damaged, and I could see why nobody ever looked at it. There was gunk, like somebody poured developing fluid over it and gunked it all up.
Do you ever try to make these pictures 3D and wear glasses while you're looking at them?
Absolutely. Yes. I try to find stereo image pairs or images that I can use to create stereo image pairs, especially in my hotter spots, the places that I find things that I find are interesting. And I'm definitely looking for stereo images or images from another mission, something. If I can put those together in stereo, I love that, because it really lets you know what you're looking at. And in some cases, what I thought was one way ended up being another way. In other words, what it was that I thought it was ended up being slightly different, although still there, which is key to this research, in that even though you don't have a stereo pair to actually analyze from, or you may not have something from another angle so that you can compare, the signature geometry is still important to pay attention to. And when these things are like, there's just not an accident. And just by the fact that we don't have multiple images to compare, by no means suggests, that would be like me saying that since I didn't have two pictures of you at my birthday party from different angles, how could I prove you were even there? Okay, and I know a lot of people, you know, like to hide behind that, and I don't know why, but they like to hide behind that, in that you can't truly tell what you're looking at with one photo. And yet we do it all day long, and look at the internet. So one single photos from a single perspective are very useful in figuring out details and determining if that's a car or not in a picture. And
did I read somewhere that you're actually producing another book?
I was working on another one. This consumes a lot of time, a lot of time, and I had to turn back to my business. And
The reason why I ask you is, knowing that you use 3D glasses and you make the pictures in a stereo manner in which you can see more detail, it would be a nice idea to have a pair of those glasses inside the book where people can actually see the details.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I thought about that. The book, the printed version of the book, is print on demand by Blurb.com. And I had no way to get them those and for them to package it up, because they're printed on demand. It's a big printing facility that they have. If I ever get hold of a real publishing house to actually put this book on the bookshelves in bookstores, I think that it would be appropriate to have the 3D glasses in there, certainly.
Well, and I'm sure in the last week we have measured our website, and people from 82 countries have downloaded the program. So I'm sure you're going to get some traffic coming your way. Let's go down to the other picture. And by the way, I agree with you. When I saw that picture, it looked like an unexploded bomb.
I don't know why that pops in my head when I look at it, but that's what I see. Like a cartoon. Just something sticking there.
Exactly. Oh, you'll see the coyote coming and exploding. Anyway, let's go to the other picture, the ABC. What do we see there? We see some houses.
ABC. Oh, why don't you hit refresh so that we're on the same page here?
Okay.
We should see the usual suspects would be next, unless you were jumping over that.
Oh, I see. Usual suspects. I'm there.
Okay. After I started finding these interesting things, I went online and started to see what other people had been talking or had been finding to see if there were anything. So this is about, you know, fall or early fall, late summer of 2007, and it was still this same stuff: the shard, this castle, that reflection in the astronaut's helmet. And I was like, "Wow, that doesn't look like anything I've been finding." And then I stumbled upon, as I point out in the book, around that time period, I'm meeting Glenn. He sent me his father's book, Alien Bases on the Moon. That was interesting. I read George Leonard's book. I went back and referenced, other things like Richard and John were up to, what they were discussing. But really, it was still all this stuff. And honestly, I don't want to belittle anyone by any stretch, because everybody's done an incredible job of trying to find something, to find these needles out of the haystack. And I don't know what these images mean when I look at them. And I think what's kind of shocking about the stuff that I found is that they're in context to the terrain around them. And I think that was a big difference. That was another reason why I said, okay, well, I've stumbled across this. I kind of feel like I should, keep going with it, because there is a difference. There's a way to evolve this. And I'm curious if there really is anything on the moon.
I honestly remember years ago, before you or the Richard C. Hoagland's of the world, the MacBearers came out with their work, and even John Lear. And I remember seeing the face on the moon. And everybody would laugh at me when I would say, it looks like a face. It looks like a structure. Look at the lines, how they intersect with each other. There's no way that's artificial. But everybody would laugh. The tone is changing. People like you, who are obviously very smart, professional, and are doing this to really prove a point, are really changing everybody's opinion. Now, the chart and the castle, were those pictures taken by the astronauts or the lunar orbiter?
I think the shard was taken from a lunar orbiter shot. I'm not sure. One of the few that it takes pictures of the horizon. I don't know much of the history on them. I just remember that they're always being used as the, that those are the guideposts that say, that there's something there. How do you term that? That they were they're the ones that have always been there for a long time, and I don't even remember who found them all, for that matter.
The castle is one of those pictures that I've seen in the past that it's almost, you can't even dispute that looks like it looks artificial.
Yeah. The only problem I have with it is it's in a sea of darkness.
Correct. What does that mean?
So the context of it, for me, I don't know. Maybe I've yet to find the picture where that is. So I went looking. I do remember I went looking for it for the original or the full frame so I could go in there and look at it. And I don't remember finding it. I just moved on. We just don't know. It certainly does. We're tuned to this. Roman, every time we see a picture of Wall Street, you got the big columns, and everybody still talks about Greece and ancient Rome. And so, to me, that all looks like columns of stuff and spires going up in the air. But that might, that we may have never picked up on that had we never had that kind of history. We may not have ever looked. You know what I mean? If we would have never been thinking columns and towers and spires, maybe we would have just passed right over that if we were looking up there for artificiality and we came across this.
Am I right in saying that we really have to take our blinders off, meaning our conventional wisdom? As you say, we look at that picture and we think of Greece, we think of the Parthenon, etc. But it could very well be something else. But what I see that's very peculiar is the actual geometry of that structure.
Here's another interesting point that a lot of people ask me about is, you know, they say, well, can't you just find this on, you know, all kinds of different kinds of rocks? Well, there's two things that I remind them of. Most people just maybe didn't even know in the first place. The moon is only made of a dozen or so basic elements on the surface. It's a big mush of stuff. And it's not at all like this, like down here on Earth, where we have a very complex, evolving geology and active Mother Nature. And we can go to the beach, and we can find so many intricate little shapes that we could say, wow, this is geometric, and this looks like, you know, we could use this as a sign of intelligent life. Not, of course, picking up beach glass, but
right,
you know,
right.
just the rocks. And because they've been beaten on and worn down and chipped, because there's an active world that it came from. When we see that strict geometry like that, and it's not as defined like lunar geology, where they're looking at like the large cracks that happen from a massive meteor impact, and you get blockiness, big chunks getting knocked around, and pushed. You know, you just can't have with an inactive Mother Nature environment. How do you get these shapes? You just can't. And we're going to see some ones down here that are just, it just still blows my mind that I even came across them. But we should probably move on to how we can train everyone's eyes so they can see when we move down the page.
Hold it right there. That's exactly what I was going to say. Before we start training people's eye and mind to see these pictures, because it's necessary to be able to discern, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back with Alan Sturm. Don't go anywhere. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to talk more with our special guest in our members section. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune in to the second part of this great show. We'll take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with more.